Court trials can determine life or death. And when they do, it's about more than just one person's fate. Our guest says sentencing and execution ceremonies are spectacles, and how we react to them reveals deeply held beliefs about the role of government in our lives. Professor Daniel LaChance is here. He is a history professor at Emory. His new book is titled Executing Freedom, The Cultural Life of Capital Punishment in the United States. The book documents the changing perception of the death penalty in America over the last half century. Daniel, good to have you on the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
That is such a provocative statement. Execution ceremonies, first of all, the idea of a ceremony, right?
Right.
Are spectacles. Spectacles that say what about us?
Well, you know, the way in which, you know, when we think about an execution, it's sort of the moment of the greatest portrayal of the relationship between a government and its citizens, right?
Yeah.
The very notion of sovereignty is the power over life and death, and this is a moment where the government makes that ultimate decision to take someone out of this world.
Yeah.
And so historically, these were very big public events up until the 1930s. Thousands of people would come and watch them. They were places where a community would reaffirm its commitment to morality, to its deeply held beliefs about what brings us together as a people. And, you know, since then, they've become these sort of secluded private affairs that are carried out in prisons in the middle of states far from where the crime occurred. And they're quite different these days, but we still kind of imagine them as spectacles.
Why did they change? Why did they change from being public spectacles to more closed off events?
Right. Well, there was a real sense that these public spectacles were actually creating more lawlessness than they were deterring or preventing. And so elites in the 19th century, you know, starting in the Northeast and then moving their way south and southwest, began to sort of try to rein in the excesses that they saw happening at the site of an execution. They had hoped that these events would be moments for people to kind of learn lessons and sort of reaffirm their allegiance to the kind of social contract. But what they were finding is that oftentimes that wasn't the case. And they were worried about the way that these executions were perhaps feeding more sadistic desires to sort of see violence and death rather than trying to put people back on or maintain them on the path towards righteousness.
There's an interesting statement in that, isn't there?
Right.
So let's do a little bit of the history work here. In a 1972 ruling involving a Georgia case, the U.S. Supreme Court said the death penalty was cruel and unusual punishment and violated the Constitution. That ruling resulted in the death penalty being struck down nationwide. And Daniel, but here's the thing. 4 years later, in yet another Georgia case, the High Court reversed the earlier ruling and declared the death penalty constitutional. Justice Potter, Stewart here. Deliver the opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Left unguided, juries imposed the death sentence in a way that could only be called freakish. The new Georgia sentencing procedures, by contrast, focus the jury's attention on the particularized nature of the crime and the particularized characteristics of the individual defendant.
So Daniel, what changed mm-hmm. in the country and with the high court in those 4 years?
Well, there's two kinds of changes happening. There's a real big sea change that happens in public opinion. You know, in the late 1950s, support for the death penalty was down. It was hovering around 50%, which is the lowest it had ever been since the 1930s when Gallup started measuring people's opinion about it. But the 1960s saw a kind of tripling of violent crime across the United States. It also saw all
the
sorts
turbulent
of,
60s.
The turbulent 60s. It also saw all sorts of social revolutions. There was anxiety about cities going up in flames every summer. Richard Nixon comes into power, you know, talking about the first civil right is actually the right to be safe in your own homes, appealing to a silent majority. And so the death penalty goes from being this kind of thing that everyone thinks we're on the road to abandoning to right at the moment when the Supreme Court is abolishing it, a kind of sea change in public opinion is taking place. And more Americans are saying that they want the death penalty, that the death penalty delivers a kind of moral clarity. It delivers a kind of justice that they so often found lacking in the government that they faced, that they found themselves facing.
In what years did we see the high point of support for capital punishment. Mm-hmm.
So support begins rising in the late 60s, and then it tops out in the middle of the 1990s at about 80%.
80%?
80% of Americans in the middle of the 1990s told Gallup that they support the death penalty.
So have a listen to Kent Scheidegger. He is the legal director of the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation, which supports capital punishment.
An executed killer never kills again. We cannot say that for certain with a killer sentenced to life without parole. Life without parole is not a zero-risk option. If we choose life in prison for killers, we do risk killing innocent people.
Does he sort of capture in that statement the sentiment of the times we're talking about, the 90s?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of, you know, violent crime starts declining in the early 1990s,
yeah.
But incarceration rates continue to rise.
Explode.
Execution rates continue to rise. So there's a little bit of a mismatch between the kind of threat Americans were facing and the response to that threat. But yeah, he captures this kind of sense that, you know, maybe the death penalty isn't a deterrent. But one thing that we can know for sure that it does do is it delivers justice to victims' family members, and it also kind of makes sure no one will ever kill again. And that really comes out of this sense that, you know, the kind of rehabilitation-oriented approach of the 1960s and the 1970s was a kind of coddling of criminals.
I remember those days when we talked about rehabilitation. We don't talk about rehabilitation anymore.
We don't. And one, part of the reasons that we don't talk about it is not only did conservatives who thought that it was kind of coddling criminals, it was part of a larger welfare state that created dependency, that eschewed personal responsibility. That's a big part of it. But it was also the left. The left was also very suspicious of rehabilitation. They saw kind of people being detained in, under indeterminate sentences in prisons until they were deemed rehabilitated by the state. And so there's this kind of bipartisan rebellion against rehabilitation, which creates the vacuum into which retribution kind of comes back.
Daniel, to what extent are we as a nation even grappling with the real risk associated with the death penalty? And we're talking about the risk that you might put an innocent person to death.
Right. Well, I think that's a big part of why support for the death penalty has declined over the last 15 years. So we sort of top out in the 90s, but if you look at the opinion polls, we're back down to where we were in the early 1960s. We're sort of back into the 50-60% support range. And a big part of that, some have argued, is the DNA revolution and the way in which DNA became this kind of way to exonerate people who had been wrongly convicted of murder, both those on death row and those who were not on death row. The kind of discussion about the death penalty shifts from the 1990s to the 2000s. It goes from, is this morally right or wrong? Do people deserve to live when they take other lives? To, are we making sure that innocent people aren't going to be wrongly put to death? And that's part of the story of why kind of Americans have taken a second look at the death penalty, and many of them have kind of started to doubt it.
And if you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Emory history professor Daniel Lachance, whose new book follows the evolution of America's perception of the death penalty. To that point, here's Kent Scheidegger again.
But ask yourself, where would those people be if they had been sentenced to life without parole instead? In most cases, they would still be in prison, and they would never get out, because an inmate who is sentenced to death gets a government-paid lawyer for the second review of his case and the third review of his case, and that is where this evidence often comes out.
So, Daniel, how many states is it? 17 still have the death penalty on the books?
Yeah, it's about that. You know, some states have it on the books and they don't really ever execute anyone. They have big death rows like California. Others like Georgia and Texas have it on the books, and you see executions almost every year.
And here's the question I'm driving at here: have the states with the death penalty still on the books concluded that the risk of executing an innocent person is an acceptable risk?
Sometimes you see that kind of rhetoric. You know, folks who have testified in front of Congress, economists who believe there's a deterrent effect, say, you know, net you're saving more people than you're putting people to death. Every public policy has collateral damage. We shouldn't throw out the baby with the bathwater. If someone who's innocent is sometimes executed, that pales in comparison to the benefits that the death penalty provide. But I don't know that really has a lot of traction with folks. Folks really do sort of have this sense that it is deeply wrong to put to death an innocent person, and that nobody should be the collateral damage of a public policy in such a draconian way.
So you haven't witnessed an execution, but you have read accounts of executions.
Yes.
What do you take away from those accounts?
Well, what's interesting is that there's this kind of gap between the way folks imagine the death penalty as this kind of, you know, it used to be this very religious public ceremony, but as a sort of an act that brings closure to victims' family members, an act that kind of expresses our moral commitments, a kind of ritualistic ceremony, and the actual life of the death penalty. So as a result of all those changes from the courts in the 1970s, appeals times have grown incredibly long. So a few years ago, the average time for those executed between sentencing and execution reached 16 and a half years. In California, it's 25. California has over 700 people on death row. It's executed in the last 40 years less than a dozen. And so the kind of world that a lot of folks imagine the death penalty bringing about, a world in which people get closure, in which there's a kind of finality that the state is expressing a moral clarity. It rarely happens. And then the actual ceremony itself, and this is the other thing that's really new about the death penalty since the 1970s and unprecedented in our history, is lethal injection. The way or the manner in which people are put to death resembles a kind of surgical procedure. It resembles an operation. So when you hear about accounts of the death penalty, journalists often struggle to sort of express what's going on as a kind of punishment because it looks like someone is just being put to sleep. And so the kind of notion that it delivers justice, that it's this ritual, that it's even punishment, right? It's harder and harder to see that when it takes forever to execute people and most people don't get executed. And then the actual ceremony itself resembles a medical procedure.
So let me play a couple of clips here from a film called The Sandman. It tells the story of a doctor who performs executions in Georgia. The doctor's name is Carlo Musso, and he doesn't exactly love the work that he does. Here he is talking about why he keeps doing it.
Quite frankly, I'd love to hang up my cleats and not do this anymore. As long as they're going to continue to perform executions in Georgia, then I think those individuals on death row deserve to have a physician present at the time of their death.
And right on the heels of that, here is Dr. Musso again comparing his work to that of a priest.
I don't think people who believe that physicians shouldn't be involved in execution would say the same for a priest. Being at the bedside at the time of an individual's death, particularly if he wanted that.
So, Daniel, why did you write this book?
It's a really good question. You know, I grew up the son of a criminal defense attorney. I grew up in Massachusetts, a state without the death penalty. But many of the guys that my dad defended over the years were really reviled, people that had been charged with raping children, people that had been charged with gruesome acts of murder. And many of them were, quite frankly, factually guilty and legally guilty, too. And so I was always sort of interested in the spectacle that his trials would sometimes produce, the way that it would bring out sort of deeply felt emotions about justice, about morality, and the ways in which we as a people respond to evil and horrible acts. And the death penalty is certainly been a site where that happens kind of potentially, perhaps most potently, that there's something about that this sort of way in which we go about punishing people that says something not just about justice, but about who we are as a people.
Daniel, thank you. Daniel Achantz, professor of history at Emory University. His new book is Executing Freedom, The Cultural Life of Capital Punishment in the United States. A pleasure. Daniel,
thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.